Seattle's Morning News. Believe it or not, there are still thousands of untested evidence kits gathered after rapes. Car Radio's Hannah Scott is going to explain why they don't do DNA testing on these things.
Well, and they do some. So when a woman is raped and reports it, they often end up at a hospital where a rape kit is used to collect evidence, including potential DNA of their attacker. Leah Griffin had to go through that process after she was raped in Seattle in 2014.
That was a six-hour procedure. And it's 6 hours of invasion and embarrassment. And to then find out that my kit was not even tested as part of the investigation was infuriating. To know that I had sat through something so incredibly probing and invasive and humiliating for nothing.
Leah is part of a legislative sexual assault task force formed a few years ago by State Representatives Gina McCabe and Tina Orwell after they realized there was a problem with rape kits not being tested.
I've been touring evidence rooms and had seen these white boxes stacked to the ceiling and asked what they were and found out they were sexual assault kits and many were not tested. And we started passing legislation to address the issues.
That legislation in 2015 made it mandatory for all rape kits to be tested, but just how many had gone untested wasn't clear. So Captain Monica Alexander with the State Patrol Crime Lab says they reached out to police agencies across the state to get an idea on how many kits were headed to the labs and ended up with an estimate then of about 6,000. Now, that was a couple of years ago. Then a couple of months ago, this bombshell.
As time went on, there were other agencies that hadn't notified us that they had kits that said, hey, we also have kits. So we don't have at this time, we know it's more than 6,000, but we don't know how much more. We're estimating somewhere between 8 and 10,000.
Now, Orwell says the state has gotten some help, including a $3 million federal grant last year for testing the backlog of rape kits, some of which are decades old.
And of course, each of those kits represent a survivor whose voice wasn't heard, who didn't get justice of what happened, and potentially some very dangerous offenders still on the street. I bet they assumed they were tested, and that's we let them down as a state.
And she says while her bill out of the Sexual Assault Task Force to help pay for testing of all of the backlogged rape kits failed this last session, there was some money in the budget for 7 new scientists to focus on that backlog. But the lab's Captain Monica Alexander says hiring new scientists is also a challenge.
The hard part is actually trying to get them in and keeping them. Because as we hire them, and we have some of the best training in the United States, bar none, but we don't have some of the best pay. You get them trained and everybody goes, wow, what great people. I can save money if I just hire them. They're already trained. They know how to do DNA testing.
She's got funding right now for 50 forensic scientists and has 6 vacancies because of that issue. And the state also outsources with one private lab for backlog tests as well. Right now, she's estimating it could take 3 to 5 years to get through the backlog of test kits. And new rape kits are also coming in, and they're taking around 6 months. And even that is too long. Earlier this year, Tumwater police arrested a man on suspicion of rape, only to find out that he was tied to another rape in Tumwater last year. Now, the rape kit from that original test came back one day before he's accused of that second rape. So that's really highlighting this issue as well. Now, Orwell says that she's hoping to improve that turnaround time in the upcoming session.
One of the things we're looking at with our state lab is there's a thing called a high throughput lab, which Ohio does, which allows them to process about 5 times as many kits as we're doing right now. And we want to look at maybe proposing that next session.
Now, it's that technology that helped Ohio clear its backlog of 14,000 rape kits with a turnaround time of about 2 weeks compared to months for us. So she's trying to get that done next session. Leah, meantime, says she wants to see more urgency by the legislature as a whole.
Because every year we don't pass a bill and every year we don't fund the testing of these backlogged rape kits is a year where we run up against more statutes of limitations. So we could get to a point where we've not gotten these kits tested for several years. You test them, find out there's a serial rapist, but now we can't convict him because the statute of limitations has run up.
How is this not a national security problem? Because we spend billions on the border to make sure bad people don't sneak in. Each one of these kits represents somebody who's already here and has done something horrible and hasn't been punished for it.
And it should be something that is addressed at the federal level. I know there are various grants. Leah's actually working with Senator Patty Murray on something else in Congress, because there's a whole other issue here. When Leah went to get, after she was raped, she went to the hospital and was turned away because they didn't have the nurse trained for a rape kit. Mm-hmm. And in our state, I believe the number is 17%, only 17% of hospitals in our state have those nurses who can even do the rape kits on hand. That's a whole other issue. So there's a lot of stuff that's going on here. The focus here is the DNA testing of these rape kits. They're working on that. I want to get one thing out here, though. One of the big things that Leah and other rape survivors are really focused on is wanting to know what's going on with their rape kit. So the state is just launching now a tracking system that is for hospitals, law enforcement,
so at least
as well as survivors of rape. It's in 10 counties right now. It's supposed to be statewide in October, so they can at least track and see what's going on with their tests.
So in other words, if you provided some evidence,
yes,
you would at least be able to know what was happening to it.
What was happening to it? If you went through and had that rape kit done, it's where it is in the process. Also, just an FYI, a state patrol lab tells me they've been able to upload 247 of these cases into CODIS, which is that federal criminal DNA database. And of those, they've gotten hits on 71. So those people have been matches.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's in for Colleen O'Brien this week. It turns out that scientific research has made great strides in understanding an organism that has so far eluded understanding, and that would be the teenage brain.
Sarah Jane Blakemore, professor in cognitive neuroscience at University College London, joins us. Sarah, please explain my teenage son's brains to me. I mean, they're still developing, right?
Absolutely. So that's only really been known in the last 15 or 20 years. Before that, it was assumed that the human brain stops developing after childhood. But brain scanning studies performed in the last 15 or 20 years have shown that that's absolutely not the case. And in fact, the human brain undergoes huge amounts of development, both during childhood, of course, but also continuing into adolescence and early adulthood.
Is there a time when we think the brain is done developing, like mid-20s or so?
A lot of the changes that we see during adolescence, both in terms of the brain's structure, like its gray matter volume and white matter volume, and its activity, its function, stabilizes in the mid-20s. But actually, it's really hard to know when the brain stops developing. In some ways, the brain never stops developing. It's constantly changing throughout life. Whenever you learn something new, your brain is very plastic and can take on new information. But yeah, the big changes that we see during adolescence start to stabilize somewhere in the mid-20s.
What you've done, though, is you've taken brain scans. I mean, you've actually examined the physical changes in the brain. So is this programmed into kids?
Well, it's not programmed into them in that the brain development will happen in all children and all teenagers, but there'll probably be subtle differences in the way the brain develops in different children. There are lots of individual differences. For example, the environment that a teenager is brought up in will have an influence on the way his or her brain develops. And by environment, I mean things like their education, their social environment, things like their home environment, how much exercise they do, their nutrition, even things like how much alcohol they drink. All of these environmental influences, we think, can shape the way the brain develops.
Any idea what electronic media is doing to our teenagers? Because that's a huge part of their environment these days.
That's a really great question. And it's the question I'm always asked whenever I give talks about the teenage brain. And the answer, unfortunately, at the moment is we don't really know. We don't know how social media and spending a lot of time on screens influences the developing brain, but we assume it does. We just don't know whether it does good things or bad things. The research just hasn't been done yet. It's starting to be done, but we don't have any answers. One aspect, though, of spending a lot of time on screens, on phones, that I think is pretty convincing is the effect it has on young people's sleep, because sleep, as we know, is so crucial for mood, for well-being, for cognitive ability, for learning. But young people often want to, you know, go keep their phones in their bedrooms at night and check their messages throughout the night. And that surely is having a detrimental effect on their sleep, which can't be a good thing.
So talk about these physical changes, because that's what got me curious. That you mentioned that there were certain environmental effects that can physically change the brain. You're not sure whether social media is one of them, but what environmental effects can you say definitely affect the brain?
Well, we know that the brain undergoes huge amounts of change, both in terms of its structure and its function. For example, if we take the structure of the brain, the amount of grey matter it contains, that grey matter is found in the surface layer of the brain called the cortex, and also the white matter it contains. White matter is found in the middle of the brain, and white matter contains long kind of fibers that connect up different regions of the brain together so they can talk to each other. Both grey matter and white matter are undergoing huge amounts of change, very substantial and protracted, slow change during adolescence. Now, most of the work that has been done so far is on average teenage brains. So we know that in the average teenage brain, there's a lot more grey matter than there is in the average adult brain and a lot less white matter. But if you look at the individual differences, they're vast. So there are huge differences in terms of the speed of change in grey matter and white matter. Some people's brains develop more quickly than others in a slightly different pattern than others. And we don't really know why. And there's probably a lot of causes to that, both genetics and environmental. But there is some indication that, for example, young people who grow up in different cultures, their brains develop subtly, slightly differently. Even things like your peer relationships seem to influence your brain development.
Okay, so now I want to ask, from an ethical point of view, as somebody's on the cutting edge of this research, if that day comes when you feel pretty certain you can predict the conduct of a student or a teenager based on these brain scans, should that information be used, or is that just a little too risky?
Well, that day is a long way off, first of all. Secondly, I think actually brain imaging data alone is never going to be sufficient to predict behavior. It might be one contributing factor that paints a kind of detailed picture that enables us to predict someone's behavior or predict their mental health. But a brain scan alone at an individual level won't do that. So I don't think it is ethical, because I don't think it's scientifically valid, and I don't think it will be.
Sounds like that's off the table then. Inventing Ourselves is the name of Sarah Jane Blakemore's book, The Secret Life of the Teenage Brain. Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The churchyard at Petersham, Surrey, is the burial place of Captain George Vancouver, after Cook, the greatest navigator in British naval history. Vancouver explored and charted the Pacific seacoast of North America. Vancouver did not found the city, which in this ceremony does honor to his name.
It was way back in May of 1792 when Captain George Vancouver sailed into what is now Puget Sound, and now slowly climbing the wooden stairway from the Bonneville Archives deep below the Broadcast Center, blinking in the sudden bright lights of the studio. Here he is, historian Felix Bunnell, brought to us by the King County Library System. This is about a local history teacher who was determined to commemorate Vancouver's visit.
Yeah, it's a story that goes back more than 200 years, and it has three distinct parts. The first part is it was this month, 226 years ago, 1792, when British explorer Captain George Vancouver visited the northwest coast. His two ships, Discovery and Chatham, sailed around our local waters and put British names on all kinds of geographic features we're still using today. Puget Sound, Whidbey Island, Mount Baker, Mount Rainier, Hood Canal, you name it, and claiming the territory for King George. Notwithstanding any claims the natives may have had who'd been here for millennia, of course. Vancouver paved the way for the British to come to Oregon country through the presence of the Hudson's Bay Company and their fur exporting operations, you know, Fort Vancouver down there in southwest Washington. Of course, Americans came too, and what's now British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and part of Montana was jointly occupied by the British and the Americans until the Treaty of 1846, which established our current border, and except for Vancouver Island, another long story, we'll get to that some other time. So the second part of the story is about this teacher at McClure Middle School named Michael Kemp Slaughter. You might remember his brother, James Kemp Slaughter. We talked to him earlier this year when we looked back at the visit of Queen Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. Michael Kemp Slaughter organized those floating cocktail parties that bid the Queen farewell and those bonfires along Puget Sound. Anyway, I met with James Kemp Slaughter at a viewpoint on the southwest corner of Queen Anne Hill a few days ago. We took in the territorial view from the Alki to the Olympics, and we talked about his brother, Michael.
He was intelligent, good-looking, loved to party and socialize, and really enjoyed his teaching, because earlier on he thought about some other things, and I didn't think he would stay with it, because I think it takes a special person. He asked me to come help one day, and that one day was enough for me, so he was the right one to go into teaching.
As a teacher, the most remarkable thing that Michael did was to help his students learn about Northwest history by creating something tangible. Now, you have a copy right there. They published this booklet about Captain Vancouver and sold copies to raise money. Then they collected donations from people and groups, all the while navigating the city bureaucracy. And what was this all for? Well, it all culminated on a sunny Monday, May 19th, 1986, with a big public event on Queen Anne at that viewpoint, all kinds of VIPs, and the unveiling of a granite monument commemorating Vancouver's voyage. It's sort of low to the ground along the edge of the sidewalk. This is what the ceremony was like.
It was a very special day. It was very well attended. There were flags all the way around held by the students, and the stone was covered with a tablecloth and a wooden copy of the ship. And the students helped him remove those. So they were very involved in the whole process.
It was all very festive, but it wasn't long after that that the story takes a pretty sad turn. Michael Kemp Slaughter got ill and then passed away in July 1989. He was just 35 years old, which is 1 year older than Vancouver was when he explored Puget Sound. So I tried to track down students from the group who created that monument, but boy, it sure is hard to find people 32 years later. Yeah. I was able to track down someone, this is the third part of the story, David Quiring of Quiring Monuments. They donated the granite monument to the McClure Middle School project. He told me how much he admired Michael Kemp Slaughter for his dedication to history, how engaged his students were. He also said that Vancouver Project inspired Quiring Monuments to launch a program where they would donate one plaque a year to similar student history projects all around the state. But here's the bad news, and this is via a bad cell phone connection. David Quiring says the program faded away after Michael Kemp Slaughter died, and he says teachers just aren't doing projects like that anymore.
Do we have kids that are looking at things like that today? I think we're missing some of that stuff. Some of this history is being thrown away, and there's no landmarks to bring it back.
But here's the good news. David Quiring told me he'd be willing to start that monument program up again. He's going to need help from a teacher or a group who's willing to help organize the statewide selection process. But if there's teachers out there or someone with a historic group who's willing to take this on, text us at 98973 and let me know. I'll connect you with David Quiring, because what a cool legacy that would be for Michael Kemp Slaughter and that forgotten British explorer who inspired him all those years ago.
I think it's a great idea. I like public art that's just sort of art for art's sake, but I don't think we have enough historic art around the city. I'd like to see more statues reminding us, and not just of Vancouver, but of the people who were here before him. Vancouver was how old when he...
He was 34 when he sailed into Puget Sound, just a young man, yeah.
Wow.
And he died at age 40 a few years later.
Yeah, well, you know, classic overachiever. And this is cute. The book that they sold is written on a typewriter.
Yeah, exactly.
And looks like it was duplicated on a Ditto machine. You remember Ditto machines?
Yeah, and they sold those for $1 a piece, and they raised $700 with that little booklet.
And where's the monument again, the plaque?
It's Betty Bowen Viewpoint Marshall Park, which is on Southwest Queen Anne Hill, just west of Cary Park. It's a gorgeous location, territorial view of the whole Puget Sound.
Historian Felix Bunnell joins us every Wednesday, and all his features are posted at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix. To the White House, some of you suspected there might be a whiff of too good to be true about all the announcements coming out of North Korea, and sure enough, we seem to have a setback this morning. I asked CBS correspondent Major Garrett if it sounds to him like Kim Jong-un is having second thoughts about next month's summit.
Well, clearly there is pushback, a hesitancy, and a clash over definitions. This is not and should never have been unexpected. This is a classic North Korean technique, and it is not necessarily going to cancel the summit, but it does inject a degree of unpredictability. It just does so publicly. I've been talking to North Korea experts for the better part of 3 months about all of this, and I can't say that they predicted this, but they said you always have to be aware that when things look promising and optimistic with North, there's a tendency for North Korea to pull back, redefine, reassert what it considers its most important motives and objectives, and then you have to haggle it out. Here at the White House, just moments ago, we talked to Sarah Sanders, the White House press secretary. She said the summit, as far as the president's concerned, is still going on. If the North Koreans don't show up, they don't show up. The North Koreans are injecting some unpredictability, but Sarah Sanders said the president is not moving off his negotiating position. Denuclearization is the ultimate goal. It'll be achieved one way or the other. And she said the president is the one driving this process. So some of the things the North Koreans objected to that John Bolton, the national security advisor, said on Face the Nation on Sunday, Sarah said that's not the model. It's the President Trump model. He'll decide what he wants to negotiate and how, and still looks forward to a possible summit. So that's sort of where we are.
But there are serious preparations going on, and are they? Do they set somebody up to play the part of Kim Jong-un in the negotiation prep? Do you know how that's working?
So this is an opaque process for a couple of reasons. One, it's never been tried before. No American president has ever imagined, let alone agreed to, a face-to-face with a North Korean dictator. Never. And so the game planning is without precedent. And we don't even know how this administration is going to build its team. One of the things you do for a summit like this is you build an entire team that handles certain issues, talks with identified people in the other country, builds momentum through conversations. All of that is at the preliminary stages. So that's another complication here. How do you do this? How do you prepare for it? And most importantly, because look, I don't think anyone expects every issue to be resolved at the summit if it happens. That's not going to be what transpires, unless there's something akin to a diplomatic miracle. So then you have to have teams that inherit whatever has been generally discussed, nominally agreed to or disagreed to, and then work those things out. And how this administration, and particularly how an even more opaque regime like the North Koreans will do that on an ongoing basis with the Americans, if in fact it goes that far, completely unknown.
Another story you can help us out with, and that is this classless comment that was apparently made during a meeting involving the president about John McCain in the context of we don't really need his vote for Gina Haspel, the new CIA director, because he's essentially on his last legs.
Dying anyway was the quote attributed to Kelly Sadler.
So why has this,
here at the White House.
Why is this metastasized? I mean, this is not the first classless comment to come out of Washington.
No, it's metastasized for two reasons. One, there is, starting at the top, a reluctance, I would say a stridency, about not apologizing. That comes from the president. It was true during the campaign. It's been true during his presidency. He just doesn't apologize. Second, there's a great sense of aggravation among those in the White House about how this got out in the first place. This was a private conversation among what we would assume to be collaborative employees working within the Trump White House. It wasn't like this happened at a public event in an open mic or a mic that someone thought had been turned off but was still on. This was a private meeting, and somebody within the White House leaked on a colleague in a damaging way. Now, that also is not new for this White House, clearly. But it's sort of taken on a life of its own because there had been some sense, at least within the communication shop, that that tendency had begun to decline. That willingness to do something to embarrass a colleague had sort of receded. No, it's in full view now. And what's happened here at the White House in the last 4 or 5 days, the conversation's not about issuing any kind of formal apology. It's been about finding who the leaker was and, if possible, getting that person fired. That just shows you how this White House, about this and so many other things, is more often than not focused internally about its own sense of upset and discord than it is about the larger message it's communicating about civility or common decency.
CBS's Major Garrett at the White House. He joins us each Wednesday. He also hosts The Takeout, which is his podcast. We broadcast it Sunday mornings at 9 here on Cairo Radio. His guest this weekend is Michael Hayden. They will talk to each other over a meal at a fine D.C. restaurant, which is a unique podcast format. Very delicious.
And now your daily dose of kindness. A young man who's graduating from Texas Tech University this summer went to school on a scholarship that he received after helping the member of an opposing high school basketball team get a basket, CBS's Steve Hartman explains.
And I know you guys get tired of me. It's little things.
At Coronado High School in El Paso, Texas, Coach Peter Morales made no qualms about it. Back in 2013, he had a favorite on this team.
Mitchell, I need you. Help me out, Mitchell.
Then team manager Mitchell Marcus has a developmental disability.
One, two, three.
But he surpassed everyone here when it came to love of the game.
He's this amazing person that our basketball team loves being around.
Yay! We have a great update on this story. But in case you missed the original, it all began 5 years ago during the last game of the regular season when Coach Morales told his manager to suit up. Just wearing a jersey was enough for Mitchell. But what he didn't know was that the coach planned to play him. And so it was. With a minute and a half left, Coach Morales put in his manager.
And just started hearing Mitchell, Mitchell.
Mitchell, Mitchell.
But here's where the fairy tale fell apart. Although his teammates did everything they could to get Mitchell a basket, each time they passed him the ball, he either missed the shot or, like on their last possession, booted it out of bounds, turning the ball over to the other team with just seconds left.
he wasn't going to be able to score. But I was hoping that he was happy that he was just put in the game.
Could you have ever imagined what happened next?
No, I did. I could not. Not at all.
What happened next happened on the inbound. The guy with the ball there was a senior at Franklin High School, number 22, Jonathan Montañez.
I was raised to treat others how you want to be treated. Just thought Mitchell deserved his chance, deserved his opportunity.
What Jonathan did was yell out Mitchell's name, then threw the ball right to him. Right there, one of the most memorable turnovers of all time. After this story first aired, Jonathan and Mitchell became friends. They received many accolades. The most significant went to Jonathan, and it came from the chancellor of Texas Tech University, who saw our story and offered Jonathan a scholarship, almost certainly the only scholarship ever awarded for a turnover. Jonathan will graduate this summer with a degree in kinesiology and our award for outstanding sportsmanship.
CBS Steve Hartman. Gotta love it when young people do the right thing.
Great story. Time now at 7:48 for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, the Shakespeare of sports, the Bard of baseball, Danny O'Neill, having penned a nuanced essay about, let me see if I've got this right, you do not condone that Robinson Cano used a performance-enhancing diuretic, but you understand it. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So explain that.
I think that the people tend to paint PED use as a moral failing, and I just don't see it that way. I think it's a mistake, but I think it's much more of a misdemeanor than it is a felony when it comes to athlete transgressions. And for all the high-minded condemnation you're going to hear about Robinson Cano, I simply don't feel that way. I think that an athlete who uses performance-enhancing drugs, that decision, while crossing a clear line, comes from the same motivation that it takes to improve themselves and wring every drop of possibility and of production out of their bodies. And I look at it as a lapse in judgment more than some sort of betrayal, which many people do feel. And that's always been puzzling to me, because I see it as a difference in degree, not in kind, over other things athletes do to improve themselves.
Danny Cano is still insisting that he didn't know this was a banned substance, that he was taking it for another health issue reason. Are you buying that?
No, I don't buy it. Almost every athlete now, when they're caught, look, here's what we know. The reason performance-enhancing drugs are banned and are such an issue is because they work. And the idea that no one takes performance-enhancing drugs and every positive test is triggered by something they didn't know about or didn't, I think would be painfully naive. When an athlete says that I didn't know what I was doing, I generally would say I don't believe them. And that certainly means that I disbelieve the excuses of some people that have them. But I think the majority of people that get flagged with a positive test were in fact cheating. I've covered pro sports for, man, it's like 20 years now. I can think of one time an athlete got tested positive, and then said, yeah, I did it. Like once. It was Chris Lieben. He's a mixed martial arts fighter. He used to live in Everett, and I think now he's over in Hawaii or maybe San Diego. But he tested positive for a steroid after a fight in England, and his response was, yeah, I took it. I just thought it was going to be out of my system by now. I had no idea it would stay in there that long. It's the only time I can remember somebody's like, yeah, I did it.
Okay, so what's next for the team now? So he's out for 80 games, and then Nelson Cruz got hit in the foot by a pitch. This is all very bad.
Yes, it is. We'll see. Now, Cruz, the good news was he didn't break his foot, because when it happened, that's Nelson Cruz is a tough hombre, and he couldn't even make it down to first. I was very worried that his foot was broken. It's not broken. It's a bruise. I don't think he'll play today against the Rangers, but that's good news. For Cano, there it looks like they're going to move D. Gordon back to second base. He's the center fielder. He's been a gold glove second baseman. It looks like they're going to move him back. Now, the one bookkeeping thing is that you get $12 million that Cano was going to make for mm-hmm. those 80 games mm-hmm. that he's not going to make now. So Ooh. You've got some spending room to add an outfielder. And I think the Mariners' decision is that, hey, we're not going to find a better second base option than D. Gordon. So let's move him there for the 80 games, and then we'll go and get somebody and put him in the outfield. We'll see what that ends up being. I'm hoping for Adam Jones, who's an outfielder for the Baltimore Orioles. He's going to be a free agent. Their season's pretty much kaput. He makes a little more money than $12 million for the rest of the season, but he's someone I'd like to see if the Mariners could bring in. But Jerry DePoto was on with us yesterday, and he said that, unfortunately, in May, there's not an awful lot out there on the market.
But the M's season is not over yet.
No, heck no. Okay. They tried to lose a game. They tried to lose it really hard last night, but Guillermo Heredia wouldn't let them. They were up 3 runs and blew that lead, and then they were up 1 run in the 9th and blew that lead, and then won it in the 11th on with Guillermo Heredia. So they're a competitive team, and I don't think that the absence of Robinson Cano is going to sink their season. And because I'm such a small-minded, amoral person, my first thought when I heard about the Robinson Cano suspension was, well, it's okay because he's hurt right now anyway.
Oh, ouch.
Oh, come on. Yeah, no, that's what I thought. He can serve the suspension while he's hurt. Yeah, that's fine.
Stop calling yourself that. You're not amoral.
Well, it's the idea that I'm okay with a form of cheating or not that bothered by it is I'm not proud of that fact.
Are you going to write a critical comment on your own column?
Perhaps. Yeah. I'll certainly. Look, anybody who knows me knows that I'm more than willing to admit all my faults.
Yes. And thank you, Danny, for being so frank and setting example for us all.
I don't know if it's an example anyone else should follow, Dave.
We go to Israel. This week we saw the dedication of an American embassy in Jerusalem, but we also saw Israeli soldiers firing on Palestinians trying to storm the Gaza border fence. Michael Friedson at the media line was there for the ceremony at the embassy, and like a lot of people in Israel, still trying to reconcile that with what happened at the border. And I asked him if the peace process collapsed this week.
Right now, nobody believes that the Palestinians want to walk away from it completely. What they need to do and what they appear to be doing behind the scenes is looking for the alternative to the virtually exclusive American control of the peace process. They've legislated for some time. They've lobbied. They've wanted to see the Europeans become more involved. They feel the Europeans are anxious to do it. And in the case of France, certainly that is the case, perhaps Germany. They feel they can get a good shake with them. But more importantly, they'll be able to live up to their demands that the United States not be part of the process anymore. And, of course, if they come down from the initial demand that they're not part of the process, then they can be part of the process, but not the whole process.
What has to happen on the ground? All this gets so complicated with all the different parties involved. What would it take to take the walls down, or at least put more doors in the walls, so that Palestinians could work for Israelis and Israelis could work for Palestinians? I mean, what's killing the Palestinian economy is that they're marooned. What does it take to open it up?
Yeah, that's one of the great ironies. The Palestinians insist they want to be separate from Israel, and yet they also complain that not enough Palestinians are getting permits to come in every day. I think it's about 40,000 right now Palestinians actually come in and work inside of Israel, which is not something that people who read the headlines every day might not find surprising. What has to happen is pretty much there has to be a neutralization of Hamas, and the cooperation between the Israeli and Palestinian security forces reaches the point to which the Hamas influence, which is the direct link to Iran, by the way, if that can be neutralized, then there can be some way to start rebuilding the kind of cooperation that we saw several years ago when Salam Fayyad was still the prime minister of the Palestinians.
So what it boils down to is trust. You have to be able to trust that people coming through the gates are coming through to work or to invest or to do, engage in some sort of business and not blow up themselves and others.
Well, having been here for about 20 years now, I'm a firm believer that the economy is the answer in many, many cases. And I really believe that if more attention was paid to the economic side of the conflict, there'd be a lot less of the people would just be too busy and too content to make trouble.
Yeah, that makes sense. That was my impression there, too, and it's been a long time since I've been there, but I guess I've been on 3 trips to the Middle East, and I looked at the place, and it's gorgeous. It would be packed with tourists in other circumstances. The history is there. I mean, you're sitting on a gold mine, And yet, because of the way it's divided up and pigeonholed and the hassle of security, it seems to be so unnecessary and fruitless the way things have turned out.
I have to tell you, we went to the a couple of the events surrounding the new embassy, and just to take the actual dedication ceremony itself, we had to, as did everybody, you couldn't drive to the location. You had to go to a local stadium, the local soccer stadium called Teddy Stadium, named after former mayor Teddy Kollek. You had to get there, either drive or be dropped off there. Then you had to go through a security clearance before you were assigned a bus. Once you were assigned a bus, you had to wait for at least three buses to fill so they could take you convoy style with a police escort to the location of the, well, what was the consulate and was now the embassy. That was about a 2.5-hour process. Then once you got to the venue of the event itself, the American consulate slash embassy, it was about another 2.5 hours after going through two more security checks and then being restricted into an area of bleachers where you really couldn't get in and couldn't get out. And that was replayed a little less tense, but it was replayed on the way out. So to go to an 80-minute event, we had to leave our home at about 11 a.m. and didn't return till 8:30 in the evening.
Jeez. Michael, good to talk with you, and we'll remain in touch. As this, I imagine this is not going to end anytime soon. I hear that demonstrations continue to go on.
It's going to be a very, very tense week, and I'll stay in touch.
All right. Michael Friedson from the Media Line in Jerusalem. Michael, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.